Acclaimed filmmaker Kelly Reichardt has been making small, and in this host's opinion, excellent films for decades now, and none of them seem to have been particularly linked to current events. Old Joy, First Cow, Meek's Cutoff, even a deep dive into the world of ceramics. Enter Kelly's latest, The Mastermind. It's 1970, and a woodworker portrayed by Josh O'Connor decides to steal four Arthur Dove paintings from a fictional Massachusetts museum. Things, as you might expect, get complicated. Films take a long time to make, and as much as the filmmakers like to try, being reactive, much less predictive, is nearly impossible. But with the film rolling out this fall, and the recent thefts at the Louvre and the Oakland Museum of California, the stars have aligned just a bit. Kelly recently joined us to talk about the film, her career, and of course, museums. The Mastermind is out now in select theaters and streaming soon via Mubi. That's M-U-B-I. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us on Museum Confidential. We're very excited to have you. I really, really enjoyed the film. I'm sure you're being bombarded with questions about having a film about art theft happening right when the Louvre happened and right when, you know, I don't know if you saw what happened in Oakland recently.
I don't know how the Oakland one turned out.
Basically, some thieves broke into their offsite, you know, storage facility, stole about 1,000 objects out of there. They have it on film, but, you know, it's a weird moment for art theft at museums. Hopefully it's not trending, but it's definitely happening. But you know, timing is everything. So when I saw this film, it seemed like even though we were going back about 55 years on the calendar and time-wise, that it was really tapping into something. What was the kind of seed of wanting to do something about art theft in general?
I've been sort of tracking art theft for a really long time for some reason. There's always art theft in one way or another. And so this more brazen kind of art theft, these snatch and grabs, this was popular kind of, especially on the East Coast where there's like small regional museums. And the thing that finally got me off the jumping off point, as it were, was an article I found. It was the 50th year anniversary from the Worcester heist. The article is about these four high school girls who got caught up in that heist. And it was a snatch and grab. And Florian Monday was the mastermind behind that one. And it happened that some friends of mine who have a small sort of rockabilly distribution, record distribution thing, they had his record. He made him 45 when he was young. So he was a singer turned art theft. But so that was kind of a jumping off point. That happened in 1972. And I set my film in 1970 for various reasons and moved it a few towns over to Framingham, Massachusetts. But that was kind of all these were sort of before the Gardner Museum, where people got serious about their guards and they got rid of the circular drive, the beautiful circular drives that used to be outside of museums, and they hunkered down.
Yeah, there's something about the time period too. You know, there was, getting to go back to a pre, you know, video surveillance, pre cell phone time. You know, the ease at which you could do things like this, it's kind of startling when you think about the access people had to these works.
You really just had to have the guts.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the main, I think, thing. And I guess you have to have something to do with the paintings afterwards. You have to have the post plan.
Yeah,
and well, my film is kind of, you know, it's sort of a heist movie for a little while, but it I guess it's largely a kind of coming undone film more than anything else. But that the place that we used as our museum is really an IMPEI library outside of inside Columbus, Indiana. And we were shooting in Ohio. And so when I found it online, I thought it was in Columbus, Ohio. But anyway, it was in Indiana, and in Indiana, there's this couple of blocks of these modernist buildings where a bunch of designers came and spent, were given money to build various buildings. And it's really in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden you're like, wow, look at this. So that was our exterior, was this library. It had the circular drive, and it was just this kind of great brutalist. I mean, it's brick. It's just a really minimalist building. And we got to sort of take all the cameras off it, which made it, you got to see it in the end in the film. You see it how it's supposed to look, which is cool. And then the interior of the museum, we built, the art department built in a warehouse off our offices in Cincinnati where we were shooting.
Yeah, I remember when I first saw the film, I thought, I don't remember there being a Framingham Museum, and I just didn't, I feel like I would have known about that. And so, and then you ended up, so it's supposed to be in Massachusetts, shot in Ohio, actually filmed partially in Indiana. Columbus, there's that great Coconata film called Columbus, which is set there. It's this weird little town of amazing modern design. Is it based on a museum, the look and feel, the kind of, it's a very warm feeling museum, which sometimes, even though it's brutalist, there's a, and the film itself has a kind of a warmth to it visually, but is it based on any memory of a museum that you liked as a younger person?
I did not go to museums as a younger person. I grew up in Miami in a very sort of, I mean, I was taking pictures, but I didn't have any. Know what anyone was doing as far as photography went, and I didn't have a lot of access to art or those kinds of surroundings. But I went to the museum school in art school. I went to Mass Art for a little while, and then I moved over to the museum school. And that was in the day. It's not anymore, but the building was a church, and that's where all the classes took place. And that was a nice environment. I found a picture of an Arthur Dove show in 1970, just one image in a gallery. And it just seemed like, well, in the way that the library is in that town, it's the right size for that town. You figure the local patrons keep it going. And that's the kind of thing it would be. And so in that actual library, if you're ever in Columbus, there's an upstairs where a tree is growing inside the building. A big tree. So it seemed the right size. I didn't want it to be gigantic. That was a big search, was what the museum could be. And that seemed like the right size for you hire the local retirees to be the guards, and it's in the center of town. And yeah, it just seemed to fit. And the Doves, the Arthur Dove paintings, seemed like that seemed like a viable place for that show to take place. And like I said, I found one image of a gallery show of Arthur Dove in 1970, and that kind of justified for myself in my own head my idea that I could use Arthur Dove for this show. In the Worcester heist, of course, they stole Rembrandt's, Gauguin, I think, in a Picasso.
Yeah, I was interested when I saw Arthur Dove's. I mean, I love Arthur Dove, and I like that period, like John Marin, and of course people like Georgia O'Keeffe and people that kind of did that kind of work at that time. But I also was curious, just in terms of like limitations and restrictions. I'm assuming, are those works in the public domain? Is that a
They
consideration
are.
to take into account?
I didn't know they were in the public domain, but thank goodness they were. Well, something I took into account, well, first of all, the name Dove is very nice for my film and the themes of my film. But the thing, and I was a Dove fan, and I thought someone like my character who's into woodworking would appreciate Dove for some reason. That like made sense to me. But I knew someone, Alec Mackay, who works at the Phillips Museum, and he's been there forever. And Phillips, of course, was the big benefactor of Arthur Dove and houses, kind of like that's where the Doves are. So I didn't even know where to begin, and I didn't know they were in public domain. So that was like a sort of practical idea. I can ask Alec, how do I even go about this? And he ended up being a great resource for us. The thing I didn't realize was Tony Gasparo, the production designer, and I, we were, just gathering lots and lots of Dove images and making these like nice color Xeroxes of them and hanging them up and designing our most ideal Dove show. Then later we started, the art director got us the dimensions of all the paintings, and most of Dove's paintings are really small. They're like 5 by 7. Some of them are 3 by 5. They're all like things like you could put them in your pocket. And so, I had this whole concept of these pillowcases getting built and having to get them out the door and in the car and all of this. And so I needed them to be of a certain mass. And so we ended up kind of curating the show by using the largest doves we could get our hands on, and that a little bit sort of directed. I mean, there were still some choices to make, but it's funny how size in the end came to dictate a good amount of the show.
You know, I don't think maybe when people think about your body of work, and I just recently watched all the films again, but when you look at like River of Grass and you look at Night Moves and you look at this, I mean, there's elements of crime throughout these films. I don't think people would initially say, you're a crime filmmaker, but there are these elements that touch on this. But this one, which separates it from those others, touches on an area that I've always been a fan of, which is kind of like when the dog catches the rabbit kind of thing, and what do they do now? Kind of the ineptness of crime, which can be kind of, this movie has some very funny moments in it where, when he's going up into the barn loft, which is just an amazing scene, and trying to move a physical object up a ladder, all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So I love an inept criminal movie, this kind of bumblingness, and you really captured that well. Is that a kind of film that you gravitate towards? Obviously, there's people like the Coen brothers and people that have kind of done that really well over the years. Was that an area you were interested in, kind of like a crime film, the art theft, but also they're not good criminals ultimately?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I grew up in kind of a law enforcement family. My mom was a undercover narcotics agent and my dad was a crime scene detective. And when my parents got divorced, my dad moved into a house with 5 other divorcee crime scene guys. It was where we spent our weekends. And though the kids in the family, we did not think our parents were that observant to anything. I mean, so we had our ideas about the faultiness of people who are supposed to be able to pick up on clues. Like my dad would always look at the dirt, the dish in the sink and say, let me guess who this belongs to, kind of thing. And he would also take us like on vacations and he'd, my sister and I'd be in a hotel room and he'd set up a crime scene, with some pillows or put some lipstick on a glass and hang a tie over the balcony. And he'd come up with a scenario that we had to figure out the order of things, But so there was always, I guess, this, I don't know how to exactly tie anything in. But the fumblingness of real life getting in the way of just practical things. The idea that any kind of plan could just be so executed perfectly. I mean, even in the art heists that are supposed to be like in Rafifi and the something has to in every art heist, something has to go wrong that fumbles the that's just the nature of the how do you get rid of the problem that's in your way kind of thing with the art heist. So, I mean, the idea of the guy who can just pull it all together, or much less the cop that can solve it all. Everyone's kind of fumbling in their role. And even the mom, Hope Davis, is fumbling in her role as mother, and Mooney's fumbling in his role as father, and everybody's kind of really fumbling along. I mean, even the thugs that meet up with Mooney afterwards, like everyone's a bit inept, as people are.
it very catches the kind of ongoing human trait of fallibility really well. Without giving the film away, because it kind of goes to some really interesting social spaces in terms of, what was going on at that time politically. Obviously, there's reflections on what's happening now. Were some of those pieces, without kind of going into too much detail, some of the kind of social reflections about that time and the upheaval in society, was that something you had always wanted to work into that, which is why the time frame was so important in terms of when you set this?
Well, speaking of fumbling, gee whiz. I mean, my earliest political memory is having to sit down in front of a TV to watch Nixon resign. And you were watching this adult get in trouble. And he wasn't just an adult. He was like an important adult and he was getting in trouble and fumbling, you know, just, you know, I grew up in Watergate and a lot of fumbling there. So, I mean, you know, that's my, the foundation of, I guess, my, maybe everyone's first political memory comes with some kind of, you know, comes at a moment of whether it's Kennedy being shot or, you know, Nixon resigning, or maybe it always comes at some moment of someone not, things not going the way you think they're supposed to go. So I've, yeah, I'm attached to that period of time for those reasons. And, you know, just, I mean, I go to the Museum of TV and Radio and watch the Watergate hearings over and over again. I don't know why. I just, you know, well, I think there's some comfort in it because you feel like
accountability.
Yeah. And like, oh, justice, or, you know, like everyone really cares about something bigger. But, you know, I think if you showed the Watergate hearings to a young person today, they wouldn't believe the emotion that's in the room. I think it would feel performative to them. I don't.
Yeah, they feel like the trial scenes in The Godfather or something like that, you know?
Yeah. How would someone whose political awareness has happened during the last 10 years even register something, you know?
How do you put the social elements inside this, you know, what could appear easily as a heist film in some way?
Well, it's set in 1970, which is, you know, I wanted to set it where we were in the kind of haze of the end of the 60s. And there's this politically rock. I mean, I don't know when life wasn't politically, you know, upheaval, but certainly there's a real huge divide in the country that maybe we've never gotten over. And so, but these things are all really, I wanted them to be, you know, this is not a politically minded person that we're following. And so the world's happening on, you know, the edges of his consciousness. He's not, and he's blocking out whenever it comes around. He's just not feeling like it really affects him or has anything to do with him. And he's got his mind on these other things, which is not great citizenship, taking art from a public space for yourself. That is... You know, that's so he's a kind of a questionable character at best.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by No Backpacks in the Gallery. Listen, we get it. You're often traveling when you're visiting museums and you need your stuff. Backpacks do come in handy, but, you know, you can't bring it into the gallery. And not for the reason you're thinking. Not exactly. Sure, you could stuff some stuff like small artworks or artifacts in there, but the real threat is the backpack itself. It's a spatial thing. Whoa, you almost backed into this Picasso. Don't turn around. You're about to knock off that figurine that's on its pedestal over there in the corner. See what we mean? They're bulky. They're unruly. They're chunky. They're ungainly. Backpacks are better off left in a locker. No backpacks in the gallery. Come on.
So your last film, Showing Up, of course, was also set in the world of art and fine art. And I loved that film as well. But, you know, but that kind of looks at it, you know, very much through the lens of a contemporary artist and kind of the artist residency space. And really, it's these very insular worlds, you know, really interesting. And then, of course, this film, you know, kind of looks at museums. And also I loved how the parents and the thing are tied into the kind of the philanthropic side of museum support. And that's, right. You know, that's such a big part of how, especially in smaller communities, you know, they're almost like these pet projects, especially at that time. You know, it was often wives of high powered men who would be at the head of the boards and running these things. So it's very much an insular world.
Well, the things that remind the mother to go to the museum is that there's a heist in the museum, you know, like, yeah, we should go more often. So, but yeah, these two worlds together, I mean, I wasn't thinking them as being related in any way, but The showing up, you know, sort of came about when I was in Los Angeles and I was in a car with these two ceramicists who were gossiping about the, you know, trials and tribulations and the politics that take place over trying to get the best kiln space and like who's, you know, kissing up to the kiln guru, who guy who runs and decides where in the kiln your place will go and who's getting the best, you know, workspace and who's who's selling work and they're not supposed to really be selling work. And oh my God, I was just like, called John Raymond, the writer I work with, and said, you know, the politics of the ceramic world, we've got to look into that. And that was kind of a jumping off place, but it was also had to do with, as it often does, with the location of that school that was the school in Showing Up was closing. And that was a really foundational place. It didn't actually close. It ended up being bought by another school, but it changed what it was, it became a middle school. But it was a kind of foundational space during the pottery craze of whenever, especially in the 70s. In the Pacific Northwest, it was kind of an important institution up until the day it left. So that was kind of in the mix. There's all different things that send you in the direction, I guess. It's hard to pinpoint exactly. Like in doing press, I've kind of come to this point, like it's this one article that was the jumping off answer to the question, but things are much murkier than that, right? And more like sort of day to day.
Gosh, I wish we had more pottery crazes. That's the world I want to get to, where we have more frequent pottery crazes.
There's a lot of pottery.
Yeah.
Tons of it. It's everywhere. There's a craze.
Yeah. Just as we wrap up here, I'm curious to know, you mentioned growing up in Florida, not having a ton of access to museums, or at least not going to them. You know, there's a ton of museums now down there, like the Perez and all these amazing museums, which have opened, you know, somewhat recently. Are museums a part of your life now when you travel around? Do you make a point to visit museums? Like, have you become a big connoisseur of museums?
Yes. The way some of my friends tour, because they're in bands and it's all about barbecue. No, it's all about, yeah, where the shows are. And I live, you know, part-time in New York because I teach at Bard College. And so I have access to that world for a good, you know, I've lived in New York for 34 years or whatever. So yeah, but that's the good part of traveling and being able to see what's going on in the, you know, otherwise, you know, so that life isn't news. Art matters, as they say. Yeah.
I was just in Philadelphia a couple of days ago, and I spent a few days going to all the great museums there. Of course, the Philadelphia Art Museum, which is really in the news right now because they just fired their director after a bad rebranding of the museum. But I also went to the Barnes Collection, all these amazing places they have up there. And I was thinking about how many movies have actually been set in museums. And Philadelphia Museum of Art, of course, Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill opens in that space.
Wow.
There's movies like Vertigo, of course, that have great museum scenes, but there really aren't a ton. Just as our final question, you know, did you look to anything in terms of films that had been in that space? Because I kind of made a list and there really aren't a ton of movies that are set in that world.
Did I go into museum world? Not really so much, come to think of it. If you're making an art heist movie, you probably don't get to go where the, I mean, you can't shoot inside a museum. Let's face it. That was a big lesson. We, for some reason, were being told we were allowed to, and we were going into this museum, and the museum owners were so sort of kindly naive to what they were saying yes to. But we were looking at each other going, they were like, well, you just need to keep the paintings on the wall. And we're like, you want a film crew in next to these five Picassos? Are you sure that's what you, a Gorky over here? And so we were, looking at each other going, yeah, this isn't going to work. This isn't. So we're going to have to build a museum. But I really didn't, now that you mention it, well, Vertigo, of course, familiar with quite well, but there must be other that I'm not thinking of right now, but
there really aren't a ton. You know, there's like some great foreign films. Like there's a beautiful film called Russian Ark that was filmed in St. Petersburg. And, you know, there's a lot of film, but it's like not many. And so, yeah. Thomas Crown Affair, like the second one, you know, with Pierce Brosnan, but there's not a lot. So anyway, my point being, this is a beautiful addition to this small field of museums films, and I really enjoyed it. And I just want to thank you for taking some time to chat with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
We touched on this briefly in the interview, but there was a real heist at the Worcester Art Museum in Massachusetts that inspired the fictional portrayal in The Mastermind. On May 12, 1972, two masked men entered the museum and stole four valuable paintings, two Gauguins, one Picasso, and one Rembrandt. The theft occurred during a busy afternoon and was witnessed by students on a school trip who had been held at gunpoint. The paintings were hidden in a hayloft on a pig farm in nearby Rhode Island and were recovered a month later. The mastermind behind this theft was tracked down in Montreal a year later and extradited. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about the station or the museum, visit publicradiotulsa.org or philbrook.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.